Good evening, and thank you for coming to this legal ethics session. We are indeed approved for 1.5 professionalism credits, which means I get 90 minutes. There are sign-in sheets around the room. If you have a sign-in sheet near you, can you just raise your hand just to indicate that you have one? There are, I think, four around. There's one there, there's one here, there's another one here. Please make sure that you sign in. If you received the email for this class, you don't need to enter your email address. It means I have it. But I do need names, particularly for those who would like to have credit. Can issue you a letter saying you were here if I don't have you having signed in. So please make sure that you do that. Those who have cell phones, if you could please make sure to put them on silent or vibrate, that would be greatly appreciated, and not just by me. I'm glad to present this program as part of Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. This is, I think, year 6 or 7 that we've been doing legal ethics programs, and glad to be able to offer them free of charge in the community. As always, donations are welcome. Okay, our topic for this evening is the dishonest client. And I want to look at it from a few different perspectives, a few different situations. First, I want to talk about just the basic rule in terms of the approach that we have, both from the law society's perspective and the perspective of Jewish law, when it comes to dealing with those who are engaged in unethical conduct. And then I want to deal with three particular questions. The first question is going to be, if I know that my client is planning to engage in dishonest conduct, I know that my client is planning to defraud investors, for example, but without using my help, what are my responsibilities? Second question will be, I'm approached by a potential client to use my trust fund. Am I entitled to assume honesty? And then the third question would be, am I obligated to leave my job or to leave a particular client rather than violate my duties when it comes to dealing with dishonest behavior? Those are the three questions that I'm looking to address. For all of this, I should note, although I am a rabbi, I am not offering practical halachic guidance with this. These are ideas we're discussing, issues we're discussing. People who have practical issues should definitely consult legal and rabbinic counsel. Yes, already we have a question.
You use three different words. You use wrongdoing in one of your versions. You use unethical.
Correct.
And dishonest.
Correct.
Which one applies?
Right. So the answer will vary based on the case that we're talking about, but yes, this is true. In some cases, we're going to be dealing more broadly, and in some cases, more narrowly, as you'll see. This is correct, though. I know. Every time I come in here, I know that. So we start off, you know, with this question of what is my obligation vis-a-vis my own conduct and the conduct of my client. And I did want to note one other caveat in the first source on the sheets. And I recognize that we may not have sheets for everybody. I did send out, by email, I sent out the digital copy the other day. And as a follow-up from this session, when I send out the follow-up email, I'll include it digitally as well. But in the first source, I included a link to a class that I gave in 2017, which talks about the case where I'm a Jewish lawyer and my client is doing something that violates Jewish law. What's my responsibility? But that's not our conversation tonight. Tonight we're talking about where, whatever it is, fraudulent, dishonest, whatever term we put on this particular case, what my client wants to do is actually in violation of secular law. Okay. Basic rules, both from a law society perspective and from the perspective of Jewish law, is I am not allowed to participate in, I am not allowed to aid unethical conduct. Even though I have a very strong duty to my client. I have a responsibility to serve the client. If you take a look at source number 2 on the sheet, from the Rules of Professional Conduct, a lawyer has a duty to provide courteous, thorough, and prompt service to clients. The quality of service required of a lawyer is service that is competent, timely, conscientious, diligent, efficient, and civil. There's a basic duty to take care of the needs of the client, and that really is a starting point in the relationship, and it exists in Jewish law as well. Somebody who accepts an offer of employment, somebody who says, I am going to work on behalf of this client, is obligated to provide quality service. Take a look at source number 3. Please, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau was a judge on rabbinical courts in Israel. He passed away, I think it's about 5 years ago now. And he writes, Muzhar HaPoel, an employee is required, and I'm going to read the English in the interest of time. I'm going to read the English aloud, but I brought the Hebrew as well. An employee is required not to cease working a little here and a little there. He must take care to be precise regarding times, and he is obligated to work with all of his powers. The employee is not allowed to take random breaks that diminish the quality of service provided to the client. An employee may not perform his own work at night and hire himself out by day, meaning a situation in which he ends up working around the clock, and the result of the work that he's doing at night for himself is that he diminishes the quality of the service he's providing to his employer during the day. He may not starve himself and cause himself suffering, as this will diminish his work for the employer. I bring this in order to show the basic responsibility that one has, not only from a law society perspective, but from a Jewish law perspective, to provide quality service to one's employer. So if that's your starting point, when do we override that duty? And what are the operating principles behind those exceptions? When do we say that we're not going to provide the service that the client wants? So the key rule for us is 3.2-7, which I brought you in source number 4. A lawyer shall not knowingly assist in or encourage any dishonesty, fraud, crime, or illegal conduct, or instruct a client or any other person on how to violate the law and avoid punishment. Right? I hope that's not news to anybody sitting here. You can't assist, and you can't encourage, and here we get the gamut of terms, dishonesty, fraud, crime, or illegal conduct, and you can't instruct the client or any other person on how to do so. So there's no assistance, there's no advice, there's no encouragement. And the same thing is true in halacha, the same thing is true in Jewish law. There is to be no assistance and no advice, and in fact, we are told not to do anything that could encourage somebody to engage in wrongdoing. An example of that, purchase of stolen goods. Take a look at source number 5, a passage from the Talmud. You're going back a couple of thousand years and to a little bit of a different society. I don't know how many shepherds there are in Toronto today. Anybody know? Are there shepherds in Toronto today? I walked into that. All right, fine. There's one shepherd. Even better. If you take a look, why didn't I think of that? If you take a look at source number 5, you get the following Talmudic warning. We do not purchase goats, kids, wool, or tufts of wool from shepherds, but we purchase stitched clothing from them because these are theirs. In other words, the way things worked with a shepherd is not necessarily clear to everybody. Not everybody knows what went on in a world that employed shepherds. But the way things worked with a shepherd was not you had your in-house shepherd who took your animals out every day and brought them back in the evening, but rather the shepherd would actually get animals from a large number of people, take them out into the wild, have them out there for weeks or months at a time, and then bring them back at the end of the season. And in that period, while the shepherd has the sheep, those animals give birth, those animals produce wool, and the wool gets cut, and there may be terms negotiated between the shepherd and the owners of the animals to ensure that the wool, the sheep, milk, whatever it is properly disposed of. So the fear here is that the terms of the agreement are that the owner is supposed to get the kids. The owner is supposed to get the wool, and the shepherd decides, I'm going to keep it for myself, or I'm going to market it. So we're told here that you can't buy goats, you can't buy wool off of these shepherds. You can buy clothing that was stitched, because that far they're not going. You can purchase milk and cheese in the wild, because the assumption is that the shepherd has negotiated a deal that he gets to keep it, because it's not going to keep if you're going to wait to give it back to the owner, but not in urban areas. The point is, we are not allowed to purchase the goods here because we think that they might be stolen. And as Moses Maimonides in his Code of Law cites this, the concern here is not so much that by purchasing stolen goods I'm violating a prohibition myself. That's between the shepherd and the owner of the sheep. The concern is that I am encouraging the shepherd to engage in theft. I am not allowed to do anything from a Jewish law perspective that is going to cause somebody to engage in theft. I'm certainly not allowed to assist by providing a market for it. I'm not allowed, again, this is in a Jewish law context, to flatter somebody who is engaging in inappropriate behavior. If you take a look at source number 6, a story from the Talmud. Going back to Roman times, there was an illegitimate king ruling over Israel. His name was Agrippus. And as source number 6 brings to us in the Mishnah, the core text of the Talmud, King Agrippus was reading through a copy of the Torah, the Bible, and he reads the text that says, "You shall not place a stranger upon yourself," meaning that if you're going to have a king, the king has to be Jewish. And he reads this text, and he starts to cry. His eyes ran with tears. And the sages said to him, "Do not fear, Agrippus. You are our brother. You are our brother." They tell him, "Don't worry about it. Don't get upset. You're legitimate, Agrippus." And on this, the sages of the Talmud comment, at that moment they became liable for destruction, for flattering Agrippus. You're not allowed to engage in what's called in Hebrew, chanufa. Chanufa is flattery. If someone is engaging in wrongdoing, you're not allowed to confirm them in what they're doing. And just the opposite, in source number 8, we find the biblical text, Lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha, hochayach tochiach et amitecha. We have an obligation to instruct people in the event that we know they're engaging in wrongdoing. We're going to talk more about that a little bit later. What we've seen so far then, in the first few minutes, is that within the law society's rules and within Jewish law, I'm not allowed to engage in, aid, encourage, instruct, certainly, in how to engage in activity which is we'll call it illegal for the moment. We haven't distinguished between dishonest and other types of illegality. So far, so good. So far, the practical instructions are identical. But interestingly, the roots of it are different. Why does the law society tell me? There are still seats up front. I recognize that's not the most comfortable spot. Why does the law society say that I am not to engage in illegal activity? That I'm not allowed to encourage somebody or advise somebody in illegal activity? What's the rationale?
Probably that don't bring down the profession.
So Reed says you bring down the profession. Right? There's certainly an issue of public perception. Okay. What else? Yeah.
It's contrary to ethical behavior.
Contrary to ethical behavior, meaning your personal behavior. Right? But I'm not on Jewish ethics. Right now I'm on the Law Society. Law Society doesn't care whether I'm Jewish or not. Yeah?
I mean, it would be like a doctor taking a Hippocratic oath trying to kill somebody. A lawyer is supposed to uphold the law.
Well, he may be required to do that. Right. But it's true. There's a certain degree to which, you know, somebody who is engaging in law in order to uphold it is now going to engage in trying to undermine it. This should be a problem. With a hand over here?
Yeah, consumer protection.
Consumer protection meaning?
The law society is not there to govern lawyers. The law society is there to protect the public. They set rules to protect the public from the actions of rogue lawyers.
Interesting. So the rules are meant to protect the public from a rogue lawyer, from a lawyer who will act inappropriately, even though the lawyer is doing it as part of client service. Okay, yeah.
A lawyer is an officer of the court, and in the event that they engage in any kind of dishonesty or encouragement, they are bringing the whole system of justice to into disrepute.
Right. It's about the system of justice as a whole. It's not only about the lawyer personally. I want to show you a couple of sources here. There is the issue of duty to the state, so to speak, which includes the duty to the court. I brought you source number 9. Eric Appleby, Legal Research Guide to Ethics. A lawyer is, as was just said, an officer of the court which requires a standard of conduct that includes a special duty to maintain and uphold the law. You have a duty to the court. It's not up to you to decide, I think in this case I'd like to advise. You're not allowed to do that. That's in terms of being an officer of the court. And then there's a duty to yourself, to who you are as a human being. And take a look at source number 10 from Hilvey Church of Scientology. It's a quote from Lord Burkett. The advocate has a duty to his client, a duty to the court, and a duty to the state. But he has above all a duty to himself. And he shall be, as far as lies in his power, a man of integrity. No profession calls for higher standards of honor and uprightness, and no profession perhaps offers greater temptations to forsake them. I don't know if that's true, that there's no other profession, but that's what he said. The message is a noble message. And it's an important message, I think, to recognize the role that the lawyer plays and the duty to yourself as a person of integrity. By the way, I wanted to call your attention to one thing back in source number 4. And again, this is the sort of thing that I'm sure you know, but it's worth pointing out. When source number 4, rule 3.2-7, talks about not engaging in, not encouraging, not instructing, did you notice who it said the lawyer is not allowed to instruct in illegal conduct? Good. Client or any other person. The lawyer is always functioning as a professional. Even in the event that you're talking to somebody who is not paying you, you're still functioning. This is part of this business of the duty to yourself and your duty to the court. Even if it's not a client, nonetheless, you're functioning as a lawyer, and therefore, all of the responsibilities remain. That's from the Law Society's perspective. Duty to the court, duty to yourself. Jewish law adds a couple of dimensions because it looks at it from a religious perspective with additional allegiances. Take a look at source number 11, please. Rabbeinu Asher makes a very important point. He says, and actually some of you may have noticed, there are flyers around on some of the tables because I and somebody else with my Beit Midrash, Rabbi Abbey, are giving a series of classes at Zeichman's, the accounting firm, and the one that I gave last week was on anonymous whistleblowing. So in that class, I quoted this as well. Kol haro'ed devar erva, anyone who sees impropriety is obligated to testify, fulfilling a biblical verse, and you shall eradicate evil from your midst. This is not a secular thing. This is a religious statement. It's saying that there is a duty that a Jew has to eliminate evil, and it's about my relationship with God. It's not about being a lawyer. It's about just being a Jew and having an obligation to eliminate impropriety. And so for that reason, there's an obligation not to engage in an improper act. And perhaps this is best summed up by pointing out an interesting ethical balance found in source number 12. There is a biblical commandment to honor one's parents. The mitzvah of honoring one's parents, as I will never tire of telling my children, is that when your parents tell you to do something, you do it. That's part of honoring one's parents. But what happens if your parent tells you to do something that is against the law, that is against Jewish law? Now what do you do? So the Talmud weighs in on this in source number 12. How do we know that if one's father says to him, become impure to retrieve a lost object, or do not return a lost object to its owner, how do we know that one should not listen? So they quote a biblical verse. You should revere your mother and father, and you shall guard my Sabbaths. I am God. So what the Talmud is picking up on is that ending. Those words at the end, the ending of, I am God, why is that necessary? In order to state, all of you are obligated in my honor. The parent is also. And therefore, Judaism will say, I may have a duty to other human beings, whether it's to a parent or to a client or to somebody else. And that person may ask me to do something that Jewish law says don't do. God is going to tell me, well, the person you're talking to also has an obligation to me. So therefore, you don't listen to what that person tells you, but instead, you follow the instructions of the religion. So what you're seeing here is, again, we don't cooperate with, we don't engage in illegal conduct. The rationale for it from the law society's perspective is because of your duty to the state as well as your duty to yourself. And Jewish tradition adds duty to God. So far, so good. That brings us to the first of our practical questions, which is, if I know my client is planning to do something that is illegal, I know my client is going to engage in fraud in this particular case, what do I do? How far do I have to go in order to stop the client? Yes, this is Woody.
Just going back to source 11 for a second.
Yeah.
Anyone who sees a client is obligated to testify?
That's the wording. When I'm dealing with lawyers, I have to be very, very careful. But that's the wording of the text.
Okay. So what about those who are not obligated to testify?
So the answer would seem to, well, let me make it a little bit more complex because it deserves one more level of complexity. The Talmud also discusses, it's the a passage from Sof, and I quoted it in the class where I quoted this past Wednesday. It also states that one is not allowed to testify as an individual in Jewish court. Jewish court relies on having two witnesses. And if somebody goes to testify alone, such that the court can't act on the testimony anyway, then they're condemned for doing so. So what that means is the term testify as it's used here should be understood loosely. And it doesn't mean, strictly speaking, to testify in court as much as it means to engage in activity which is going to bring a halt to the wrongdoing, the impropriety that they are observing. So if one is in fact eligible to testify, you have the two witnesses standing there and they're able to go to court, then that may well be their route. However, if they're not in a position to do that, they need to find some other avenue for, as it's put here, we are Rabbi Kirbacha, to eliminate evil from your midst. They may need to find some other way to do it. Yes?
But that same halachic provision is also in the rules of professional conduct. So we have a affirmative duty to report misconduct. And if you report,
so the answer is yes and no, right? The statement was made that there's a professional duty to report wrongdoing. Is that true? Yeah.
To report wrongdoing against other members of the bar, not against your own client who may have given you privileged confidential information and said commit a crime.
Correct. So here we have to be a lot more careful. First, I mean, I'm going to distinguish between confidential and privileged and stick to confidential because privilege is more the technical issue of the court, and what the court can ask for. But in terms of confidential information, when you say that there's a professional obligation to report, there are very specific parameters of what you report and to whom you report it, and that's exactly where we have to go with this. So hold on, I know you're going to talk about it, but let's see what we have here. The general principle from the Law Society's perspective, operative not in all cases, but in most cases, is you go up the ladder within the business, and if you're still not finding satisfaction, then you leave. You say, I can't continue with this retainer. The option of going outside of the business in most cases is not present. We're going to talk about exceptions to that rule. But as a general rule, that is so. Meaning, I have a duty to... I keep saying I. I'm not a lawyer. They, I'm married to one, but I'm not a lawyer. So let me not make sure not to misrepresent here. But the lawyer has a duty to preserve lawyer-client relations, so any information she learns in her professional capacity is not to be disclosed without consent. That's a very important bedrock principle. Take a look at source number 13 from the Rules of Professional Conduct, Commentary to Rule 3.3-1. A lawyer cannot render effective professional service to the client unless there is full and unreserved communication between them. At the same time, the client must feel completely secure and entitled to proceed on the basis that, without any express request or stipulation on the client's part, matters disclosed to or discussed with the lawyer will be held in strict confidence. The client has the right to assume that all information is going to be kept confidential, and you need that, right? Because if you don't have confidentiality, your whole system of representation falls apart. Because they're not able to trust the lawyer, they're not able to discuss with the lawyer what their plans are and what's going on. The client has to know, and we've discussed this before, we've had classes on confidentiality, the client has to know that things are going to be kept confidential. There is the opportunity to disclose information in order to prevent certain kinds of harm. Take a look at source number 14, rule 3.3-3. A lawyer may disclose confidential information, but must not disclose more information than is required when the lawyer believes on reasonable grounds that there is an imminent risk of death or serious bodily harm, and disclosure is necessary to prevent the death or harm. You notice, of course, the key word in this paragraph describing what it is that the lawyer does. A lawyer may disclose, not must disclose. Why is that may instead of must? Right, but why? Yeah. There was someone's.
It's discretionary. I guess it depends on the facts.
It's discretionary. More than that, it is a judgment. Sorry.
If he believes. Yeah.
It's a judgment thing. More than that, I think it's about preventing liability. If you say must, then in the event that the lawyer makes a mistake and does not disclose, that's going to come back to get the lawyer in a lot of trouble. Keep in mind, we're in Ontario. In Ontario, like in almost all of Canada, right, all but Quebec, there is no duty to rescue. Yeah, you know, barring special relationships with people, barring special roles, a teacher or whatever, I'm not dealing with special relationships. Generally speaking, there is no duty to intervene in order to prevent somebody from suffering harm or even death. Morally, ethically, from a Jewish perspective, you bet there is. But from a secular perspective, there is not. And therefore, the lawyer may choose to disclose it. What the Law Society is doing with this rule is saying, we're not going to keep you from speaking up when you think your client is about to shoot somebody. But we're also not going to put a law on the books that says that you have to convey that that information. That's what they're doing here. And the result of it is that in the event that the lawyer is working for a business and believes that the business is defrauding people, does the lawyer have the option of telling those potential victims? Absolutely not. The lawyer who goes to the media, the lawyer who goes, forget the media, the lawyer who goes to whatever overseeing body of that industry exists and reports it, is violating the rules of professional conduct. They're not allowed to convey that information. And so what they do is they go up the ladder within the business, and then after that, as I said, they withdraw. Interestingly, the idea that the lawyer should be able to report in order to prevent financial harm has been considered, but it's been rejected. If you take a look at source number 16, I'm not sure why I put 15 there. I'm not sure what I was doing with that. I may come back to that if it turns out that it's floating from some other part of my source sheet. But take a look at 16. Article, in-house whistleblowing. Where do your loyalties lie? The financial scandals of the 2000s, beginning with Sharon Watkins blowing the whistle on Enron, put the issue in the public eye. This is the issue of financial wrongdoing that the lawyer becomes aware of. In the aftermath of the scandals, major reforms were made in financial reporting. As part of the reforms, the American Bar Association amended its rules to include third-party disclosure. Model Rule 1.6b3 permits lawyers to disclose information, quote, to prevent, mitigate, or rectify substantial injury to the financial interests or property of another. Model Rule 1.13 also allows lawyers to disclose information to third parties, quote, to the extent the lawyer reasonably believes necessary to prevent substantial injury to the organization. This is in the U.S. So far, she writes, Canada has not followed the U.S. model. The Federation of Law Societies of Canada reviewed the new ABA rules but decided not to move forward in amending the Model Code of Professional Conduct. In 2010, the Advisory Committee on the Future Harm Exception recommended the rules be amended to include disclosure based on imminent risk of substantial financial injury. The proposal in 2010, right, they came out with a new set of rules of professional conduct in 2010. The proposal was, let's include financial harm as a factor. But following consultation with the law societies, it was agreed that more discussion of the proposed future financial harm rule was needed, says Tom Conway, president of the FLSC. In March 2011, the matter was referred to the Federation's Standing Committee on the Model Code of Professional Conduct. The issue is on the committee's issues list and will be considered in due course, along with all the other issues that are on the committee's issues list. I don't know how long that list is. Law societies have also looked at the issue. In the Law Society of Upper Canada, Oliver Shalom, now the Law Society of Ontario, Rules of Professional Conduct, the commentary under Rule 3.3, Justified or Permitted Disclosure, makes it clear that even with imminent financial harm, lawyers are not permitted to disclose to third parties. In the commentary, the rules state that while lawyers should not knowingly encourage or participate in any wrongdoing, it does not follow that the lawyer should disclose to the appropriate authority and employers or clients' proposed misconduct. So that's where things stand in Canada, is you don't disclose in order to prevent financial harm. However, there are at least two cases, one for certain and one I'm not sure of, but there are at least two possible cases in which a lawyer would indeed disclose, even though it's not about saving lives. It's not about life or death. The first case of the two is where your duty to the court overrides your duty to the client. So take a look, please, at Appleby in number 17. The lawyer is an officer of the courts. A lawyer, when acting for a client, has a prior and perpetual retainer on behalf of truth and justice. And there is no crown or other license which in any case or for any party or purpose can discharge him from that primary and paramount retainer. It's really remarkable. Those who are familiar with Talmudic language will recognize this phrase. It's almost straight out of the Talmud. The Talmud talks about somebody who takes an oath to violate the laws of the Torah. And it says that the oath is not binding because he is, in the wording of the Talmud, Mushba ve'omed mehar Sinai. You already took an oath at Sinai that you're going to fulfill this covenant, and therefore you can't take some later oath to violate it. That's what Appleby is talking about here. You already have a prior and perpetual retainer on behalf of the court, and therefore no client is going to be able to get you to override that. Therefore, in the event that the court says you have to speak up, and assuming the information is in fact not protected by privilege, you don't have the option of saying, well, this is confidential on behalf of my client. So that's one that will override. And then the other one is one that I'm not sure of, and maybe people here could help me with this case. You're familiar with the case of Edgar Schmidt? No? Okay. So, good. Then I will be able to say something. Take a look at number 18. Edgar Schmidt was a lawyer who worked for the Department of Justice. His job was to draft legislation and to review legislation. And apparently there is a rule that the government is supposed to, in the course of putting forth legislation, is supposed to review it to make sure it doesn't violate charter rights. Well, Edgar Schmidt felt that the standard the government was using was inadequate. What the government was saying was, if there's any argument we can make to support this legislation being okay, we can put it forward. He argued that if he finds, as a reviewer of the legislation, he finds sufficient reason to say this actually does run afoul of charter rights, the government can't put it forth. So he wanted a stricter standard employed. He did not get satisfaction within the government, and so he sued the government. That was his way of dealing with the problem, and of course, in so doing, disclosed what had been going on. Well, the government immediately suspended him and said, you're not allowed to disclose what's going on internally. You violated confidentiality. Let's take a look at source number 18. Whistleblower Edgar Schmidt loses charter suit against his former department. Former Department of Justice lawyer Edgar Schmidt has lost his bid to sue the ministry that once employed him for failing to report to Parliament whether new laws might be so inconsistent with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms that would trigger constitutional challenges. Under a 1985 law, the Justice Minister has a duty to inform the House of Commons if any draft or proposed bill violates guaranteed rights. The law might as well not exist. No Justice Minister has reported a proposed government bill for its possible unconstitutionality in 31 years. So keep in mind, this was 2016. That means ever. From 1985 until that date, 31 years they've been reviewing legislation. No one had ever actually said, yeah, this law has a problem. This law is not going to match. Well, the Federal Court of Canada ruled against Schmidt Tuesday, saying it was satisfied with the government's standard of credible argument. The proposed bill need be reported only if no credible argument can be made to support it. So he lost the case. Of course, there was an appeal. I don't believe the appeal has gone anywhere. But in source number 19, we get the key, which is part of the government's case here, is an affidavit saying the following. If a legislative drafter cannot remain loyal to the client and respect the instructions of public servants and public officials, the ultimate remedy is for counsel to withdraw from the employment relationship and resign. Where there is disagreement with the client, like other public servants or government counsel, legislative drafters have three options. They can strongly present their views and put forward other options for consideration. If this does not resolve the matter to the employee's satisfaction, the next step is for the employee to ask to be assigned to different tasks. Lastly, in extreme cases where these options have not worked, the employee can resign. That is the only accepted ethical course of action for counsel, as appears, and so on. So the thing is, I don't think the government won on that point. In other words, the court sided with the government in terms of the standard for reviewing legislation. However, the court also ordered the government to pay costs for Edgar Schmidt's legal defense. And not only that, but you had a rebuke, which I brought you in source number 20. You had a rebuke to the government for suspending him. This is from Justice Noel. Federal Court Judge Simon Noel heard from the two sides in the Schmidt case Tuesday and criticized Ottawa's swift response to the lawyer, who considers himself a whistleblower acting in the public interest. The day after the filing of the statement, bang, you're suspended, said Justice Noel, pointing out to federal lawyer Elaine Prefontaine that the government has taken away Mr. Schmidt's income and reputation. It's unbelievable. Your client has done everything it can to kill this thing. The court doesn't like that. We see that in different countries, and we don't like it. Canada is still a democracy. So it is possible, and again, I'm not clear on it, but it sounds to me, and tell me if you read it differently, that there is another justification beyond prevention of bodily harm, serious bodily harm, and beyond where the court has demanded the information. It seems like there's another level to it here, which may be classified as the public, I don't know what, it's not public interest, it's stronger than that, but somehow the need of the public might actually override confidentiality. Are you hearing what I'm hearing in this? Is that, or am I overreading it? Yeah, Michael.
It says the reason the federal court ruled against Schmidt was because it was satisfied with the government's standard of credible argument.
Right.
Which suggests that if the argument, there is a certain level, that you have to have a certain level of argument. If you haven't been a credible argument, if it hadn't been meeting a standard of at least credible argument, if it hadn't been meeting at least a lower standard, it sounds like he would have been okay.
Right. But in any case, that's a loss on the merits of the case. But the fact that he went to the length of suing them and disclosing this doesn't earn him censure in any way. And in fact, the government is criticized for having suspended him. There was another hand I saw. I don't recall where. I think you had your hand up.
Well, I was going to ask how the notwithstanding clause affects that. Because they can pass something that doesn't meet the standards of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
Right.
They could say, I'm planning a use of the notwithstanding.
Well, that would be true if we're provincial, right? Does the federal government have the right to use the notwithstanding clause? Federal government can use it also. But that would be very interesting. I don't know. Yeah.
I'm wondering from a procedural perspective, if this was a federal court case, I'm not sure if it would have been an actual issue decided by the judge whether or not it was an ethical violation by Schmidt to disclose. Like, I wonder if the government could simultaneously make a law society complaint and they'd have some success, but the judge said, well, generally what Schmidt did was fair, so I'm going to award him costs despite the fact that he lost, but that wouldn't necessarily excuse him for disclosing.
Right, and that's why I think it's vague. I'm not clear on whether they're really exonerating him or whether it's saying that the government never chose to pursue. We don't find anything in the records in Manitoba of the Law Society considering this case. Yeah.
Pulling McNair's affidavit and the options, if you just spin the facts around a little bit, he would have otherwise had the right to actually disclose. For example, if he were to resign and they were to sue him, or if, for example, it was constructive dismissal, and he was suing them for constructive dismissal, then of course all of the facts of his opinion to them would come out, the file might be sealed, but he would have the right to put forth his arguments as to why there was a dismissal.
In other words, if the government chose to take action that endangered their own confidentiality, and he can't initiate that. The government may choose, unwisely perhaps, to do that.
He gave advice to his client, the government, that they were acting incorrectly.
Yeah.
And he asked to be assigned to another department. And he said, no, that would be constructive dismissal.
Okay.
He would sue for damages. His opinion and all the circumstances surrounding his dismissal would be fair testimony in order to justify his actions.
Right. So that's beyond my expertise. I don't know how that would play out. Yeah.
A simpler example of that, you can sue your client for not paying your bill.
Right.
And you disclose the minimal amount of confidential information. Like it's confidential that they're even a client, but you can disclose that they are a client and sue you reimbursement for not paying your bill, and then they, in their defense, will disclose some confidential. So the whole proceeding which you're allowed to engage in is a big disclosure of your client's confidential information. I believe the rules specifically provide that you can
do that.
Disclose as much as necessary to collect your bill.
Yeah.
It seems that, based on this, that things changed when the charter came in. In other words, before the charter, this law seemed to be contemporaneous with.
Yeah.
So this right, the charter created this obligation. It was never a free charter when there's listed Bill of Rights, and that's it. It could be that there was, that you wouldn't know, it wouldn't have no obligation to disclose anything that you know. Anything that would.
What came in with the charter was the specific case at hand, was the question of whether the government needs to review.
Violations of charter rights involved in this legislation, but prior to the existence of the charter, there wouldn't seem to have been a right at all to report any.
Well, I don't want to confuse two things. The substance of what he was upset about doesn't relate to the question of whether he can reveal their information. The substance of the case is interesting in its own right, but it's not really part of the discussion about confidentiality. That's just the case that happened to be at hand.
You're saying that maybe there is another right besides
Right. I think that there may be another grounds for disclosure, and that is some kind of serious public, I don't want to call it interest because that trivializes it. But I'm going to go a little further with this. I don't want to get bogged down too much in this case. This is all from the Law Society perspective. The Jewish law is actually going to be much stricter in terms of what it expects me to report and how it expects me to report it, because I have a religious duty to prevent harm in multiple directions. Number one, I have a duty to prevent harm to the victim of the wrongdoing. So if my client is going to commit fraud, even if it's just financial, I have a duty to prevent that from happening. If you take a look at source number 21, passage from the Talmud, commenting on a biblical verse from Leviticus. How do we know that one person who sees another drowning in a river or being dragged by a beast or beset by bandits must act to save him? And the biblical verse says, Lo ta'amod al dam re'acha, you shall not stand by as the blood of your peer is shed. Now, this is generally understood to refer not only to life and death harm, he's drowning in a river, but also where what he's going to suffer is financial harm. Now, you could make the argument that if you disclose the information about what your client is doing, then you're harming your client, right? Harm is going in multiple directions. There's a biblical law that prohibits disclosing people's private information. Lo telech rachil be'amecha, the biblical text says, you shall not travel as a peddler going around and peddling, literally, stories about people. So you could make the argument that I am robbing Peter to pay Paul. I am saving the victim, but I'm doing so at the expense of my client. You could make such an argument. However, in an odd twist, both of those rules, the rule that you're not allowed to peddle stories, and the rule that you have to intervene to prevent harm, are found in the same biblical verse. The biblical verse goes, you shall not travel as a peddler, do not stand by while somebody's blood is shed. And to take a look at the formulation found in source number 22, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, former Sephardic chief rabbi of the state of Israel, in which he said, one should also explain thus the meaning of the verse, do not go as a peddler among your nation, do not stand by as the blood of your peer is shed. Read it as a full sentence. Even though you may not be a peddler and reveal your peer's secret, still do not stand by as the blood of your peer is shed. You must inform your peer so that he might avoid harm and danger. In other words, the second half of the sentence overrides the first half of the sentence. Yes, it's true, I'm not allowed to tell tales, but in the interest of saving somebody from great harm, and yes, even financial harm, I am justified in disclosing that information. So number one, Jewish law will say, I have to prevent harm to the victim. Number two, Jewish law says, I am supposed to prevent the criminal for the criminal's own sake. I'm supposed to prevent the criminal from engaging in wrongdoing. This is what we referred to earlier as the mitzvah of tochacha. I have an obligation to educate the criminal, and I have an obligation to God. As we already said, I am supposed to try to eliminate evil. So because of that, Jewish law is much more strict than secular law is going to be. Whereas the Law Society is going to say, report it within the company and you're done, unless you're dealing with life and death due to the court and maybe this very significant interest to the community, Jewish law is going to say, if you can't get satisfaction within the company, you go outside of the company in the interests of saving people from harm. Now this sets up a real problem, right? Because what do you do then? If I am, which I am not, a lawyer, and I am an observant Jew, okay, one out of two, so now what do? The Law Society is saying, well, it's financial harm. You can't say a thing outside of going up the chain of command within the company. Jewish law is saying to me, I have a duty to speak up. Now what do? So I'm going to come back to that in the last part of this. But before we do, I want to shift gears to something a little bit less fraught. And that's the second question that we had. We've dealt with our first question, We've dealt with the question of what am I supposed to do in the event that I'm aware that my client is in fact engaging in fraud. But the second question, the issue of default credibility. I am approached by a potential client to use my trust fund. Am I entitled to assume honesty? I've got a no over here. Anybody want to say yes? That you can assume honesty, meaning that he comes to you and he says he wants to run some kind of let's say he's going to develop a property and he wants people to put their money in your trust fund when they put down their down payments on the property that he is now developing. He would like it to go through your trust fund. Are you allowed to assume that everything he's doing is on the up and up? Do you have any duty to investigate? Yeah.
You're supposed to question your client to understand their business to the extent possible. I mean, you're not supposed to dive so deep that you're, you know, sending private investigators out to know. But if someone's developing a property, you should try to ask to see the plans, understand the property, see the benefits of the corporation, right? So you should have an understanding of what they're doing.
Okay, so we're saying that you do have a duty of investigation, although not to great extremes. Okay, yeah, Joel.
My recollection is correct. The large Jewish law firm, the city, which no longer exists, took money in those types of syndications, and right at the beginning of their letter, it said, we are not your lawyer, we are acting only as a depository. I don't know how far you get today, but that's the point.
So they had a practice of simply saying to the client, we are not your lawyer, we are acting as the depository. Anybody think that's satisfactory? Yeah, I'm actually fairly sure it's not. Take a look, please, at source number 23 from the Rules of Professional Conduct. A lawyer shall not act or do anything or omit to do anything in circumstances where he or she ought to know that by acting, doing the thing, or omitting to do the thing, he or she is being used by a client, by a person associated with a client, or by any other person to facilitate dishonesty, fraud, crime, or illegal conduct. In other words, even though you're not the one engaging in this illegal conduct, for dishonesty, fraud, crime, whatever term we want to put on it within this rule, if you sense that you are being used, if you ought to know that you are being used, that is sufficient to warrant that the lawyer not allow herself to be used. The second part of this, when retained by a client, a lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to ascertain the purpose and objectives of the retainer. I think that goes back to the investigation point. And to obtain information about the client necessary to fulfill this obligation. And there's a case, I brought you a piece of it, Scott v. Valentine, in source number 24, in which somebody duped investors by using the trust fund of a reputable lawyer to deposit the funds. And that gave the appearance of legitimacy. In other words, they get their investors and they say, I'm making up the name of a law firm. I hope it's not the name of a law firm in Toronto. But, I don't know, whatever it is. Smith and Smith and Smith and something or other. There you go. And it's a firm that everybody knows and that everybody respects. So the people who are the prospective investors think, well, if that firm is involved, this thing must be legitimate. And of course, it was not legitimate. So take a look at source number 24. This is from the ruling on the case. And it says, what happened is, in this case, and this is part of what the court is ruling on, the investors are upset, and the investors are claiming damages from the law firm. So what the court says is, the investors have no claim on you. However, the Law Society has a claim on you. It says, I do not agree with Mr. Shurkin's position that there is at least an argument to be made that the defendant, I do agree with Mr. Shurkin's position that there is at least an argument to be made that the defendants breached the rules. That said, the breach, if one can be shown, may well go to whether the conduct of the defendants breached their professional responsibilities. But in and of itself, such a breach does not generate proximity where none exists. In other words, you as the lawyer whose trust fund was used had no obligation to the investors. You have no professional relationship with them. You don't know them. They don't know you. You never made any statements or commitments to them. They can't come back to the lawyer and demand any sort of compensation. However, the Law Society says you breached the rules because your responsibility was to make sure to do that investigation that we talked about in source number 23, that the lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to ascertain the purpose and objectives of the retainer. That's from the Law Society's perspective. Clearly, it doesn't force the lawyer to become a private investigator and dig out every detail, but it requires that the lawyer satisfy herself that what's being done is on the up and up. Jewish law, quite frankly, is a lot more trusting. Does not make that same demand. When you're dealing with relations between man and God, when you're talking about a spiritual matter, let's say the question is, I want to go eat food in somebody else's home, the assumption is that the food is kosher. I don't need to do an investigation of, is this food kosher? The assumption is, the food is kosher. I should state very carefully, that's assuming that the people in general are people who observe the laws of kashrut, and assuming that people are knowledgeable about the laws of kashrut. People can make mistakes very easily. So we're talking about where they are indeed knowledgeable. So then the assumption is that it indeed is fine, unless they have particular considerations. If you take a look at source number 25, a passage in the Talmud, one may not purchase wine, muris, milk, salkandri salt, chiltit, or cheese in Syria other than from a certified person. It's a passage in the Talmud dealing with products which were known to have kashrut problems in them. So, for example, I don't know if people are familiar with muris. It's not so popular today. It was very popular in Roman times. It was considered a delicacy. Basically, what you would do is you would take fish and you would let it age to the point where it starts to really smell bad, and then you'd pickle it. And you'd make this fish brine. And there were different kinds of fish brine. The Romans loved it. Maybe that has something to do with where the Romans went. But it was considered a good idea back in the day. So there were issues of fish brine because it often had non-kosher wine that was mixed into it. So certain products were known to have issues. But if you don't know that there's an issue, the default is that it's okay. Maimonides rules it in number 26. One who stays in someone's home, anywhere and at any time, may eat the wine, meat, cheese, or fish which the host provides without inquiring after him. This is true even where one does not know him, but knows only that he's Jewish. However, where he is known, where the host is known not to be, quote, kosher, and not to be careful in these matters, one may not stay with him. One who transgresses and stays with him may not eat meat or drink wine on his word without the testimony of one who is, quote, kosher. So if you know there's something wrong, that's a different story. But otherwise, you assume that it's fine. There is no duty of investigation in this regard. And the same thing is true, not just in the laws of kosher. Hang on. The same thing is true, not just in the laws of kosher, but in terms of social issues. Remember we said in the beginning, I'm not allowed to go to the shepherd and buy the young goats. I'm not allowed to go to the shepherd and buy the wool off of the shepherd. Why? Because there's a suspicion that he came across this, not legitimately, but through the animals that were in his care. But if I just walk into a store, I don't demand to see the pedigree for the wool that they're selling me. It's assumed that the wool they're selling me is fine. I don't need to do that kind of investigation. Motion.
Does this mean that you can't tell someone else to stay with them? In other words, you visit a relative, you visit somebody else. You're not told you can't stay with them?
So that's a longer discussion, which I don't want to... The answer is no, you may stay with them, but their concern here is about other things that may happen in the environment that he's describing. I'm not... It's a good question, but it's a separate one. When you're dealing with other people's money, you do have certain other obligations. in terms of caring for it. And I gave you a link at number 27 to a class that I've given on the topic of managing other people's money and the ethics that are involved there and the tolerance for risk. But in terms of our discussion and what we're talking about here, the law society is stricter than Jewish law. When it came to the issue of the responsibility to report a threat to others, to report danger to others because of dishonesty, because of fraud, because of illegal conduct, Jewish law was more strict than secular law. However, when it comes to the issue of suspicion and default credibility, the law society is stricter in saying there is no such thing as default credibility. You're going to be required to investigate before you let somebody use your trust fund. Are we clear on that so far? Okay. That brings us to our third and last area, which is, am I really obligated, as I put in the heading above source number 28, am I obligated to leave my job rather than violate my duties? And the Law Society says, you bet. Take a look at number 28. Subject to the rules about criminal proceedings and the direction of the tribunal, a lawyer shall withdraw if A, discharged by the client, B, the client's instructions require the lawyer to act contrary to these rules or bylaws under the Law Society Act, C, the lawyer is not competent to continue to handle the matter. That's actually not the passage from the rules that I wanted. But it'll do. It'll do for our purpose. It's not the exact one that I wanted, but it's good enough for these purposes. If the client's instructions require the lawyer to act contrary to these rules, then the lawyer is going to need to withdraw. You can't continue with the retainer. Yes.
So if you're in a situation you decided to withdraw, and you know that the client said one lawyer B, do you have any obligation to warn the lawyer B about this?
Good. That's a really good question. The question is, do you have an obligation to notify your successor about what it was that you found? And I don't want to go out on a limb by answering without having double checked. I did read up on this at one point, but it's a while back. If I remember correctly, the answer is you don't go to the successor, but if the successor asks, then I think it is considered fair for you to share the information. Does anybody remember this before I completely blow it? I'm on the record, so I want to make sure that we get this right. Okay, so what I'm going to do is what I always do with stuff like this, which is when I send out the follow-up email from the class, I'm going to include it there. I'll look it up first and then answer it, because I'm not 100% sure that I'm remembering this correctly. So that's why I'm hesitant in what I'm saying. I was pretty sure I remembered reading it, so that's why I want to look it up before I give an answer. Was there a hand back there? Anybody had the answer? Oh. Yeah.
I don't want to not pause it, but I understand that without
the client
from.
So you're saying no. You're saying you would not be able to.
The first time the process says to you, okay, you're not going to speak to anyone. I know that you're on to me, but don't speak to anyone ever again. That's it.
I mean, it's logical. The position you're taking is logical based on everything we've said about confidentiality. It would sound right. I want to double check because the rules have a specific section about talking to the successor, and I don't remember offhand enough about what it says. Yeah.
Unless you feel somebody's life is at stake.
Right. If the life is at stake, then it's a different ballgame altogether. That's correct. That maybe? Yeah.
Is a lawyer obligated to defend his client if the client admits to him that he's guilty of something, fraud or murder or whatever? How can the lawyer go into court and argue he's not guilty or get involved in some technicality?
Right, you're never supposed to ask the client, are you guilty?
Somehow we know. Somehow we can't.
Right.
So in that sort of situation, if you're already leading to a trial, it's too late to withdraw, and they want to lie, you need to counsel them that you cannot assist in the lying, and essentially what you do is you say to the court, my client wishes to take the stand and testify, and then you sit down.
Right. This is a more complicated issue than that, and it's not directly relevant here, so I'm going to...
Rabbi, can you even put him up on the stand? I don't think you can put him up on the stand if you know that he's...
So I think you let him take, as Eitan said, I think you let him take the stand, but you put him up.
Don't put him up.
Yeah.
You let the court know that he wants to testify, and you cannot even think
right. of the So from the Law Society's perspective, if the client wants you to violate your obligations under the Law Society Act, the answer is you quit. You don't go any further. What about from a Jewish law perspective? If he wants you to violate Jewish law. Yeah, Johan.
Just one question in terms of violation of the law. The law is from the perspective of both the Law Society and Zlaka is from the perspective of Ontario law and Canadian law. Because there are a lot of disconnects between the laws different domiciles, and in some cases, heaven forbid if you're in a country like Nazi Germany or Iran, you might want to actually help.
No, but how does that fit with this?
No, but that's a dilemma where that you might face, where the government is actually following a course that's simply not proper.
So I'll tell you what, that I'll take later, afterwards, because that's a whole other question of challenging the legitimacy of the law. We're working from the starting point that this is legitimate. And then the question is only, so what is it that I'm expected to do? So again, the Law Society's principle is that you're not to continue with the retainer. I see two hands. All right, Mark. All right, so you know what, I'm going to hold that until later also, because again, that's not directly on where we're going. With the hand over here also, on this point there, yeah.
It may have been more directly related to source number 28.
Yeah.
And that is that it's one thing to say that a lawyer can no longer continue that retainer for that client, but... where the problem is widespread and endemic, is one required to leave that area of practice.
And you're not asking a Law Society question now. You're asking a Jewish law question. The Law Society will say there's no such thing. No, that's going to be their answer. You're going to take it retainer by retainer, case by case, and say quit whenever you think it's inappropriate, but there's no such thing as quitting a field of law for that. That's not even going to be on their radar. From a Jewish law perspective, that can absolutely come up. It can be that there is a case, that there is a field of practice in which the norm and the accepted practices are such that Jewish law wouldn't accept them. So here we need to distinguish between the different duties that Judaism looks at. In terms of the duty of not engaging in wrongdoing personally, then Judaism will say, as the Law Society says, you got to back away. You can't take a retainer that's going to require that you do something that puts you in conflict with Jewish law directly. However, when it comes to the duty to not encourage wrongdoing, then Judaism takes a different stand. And it suggests that where one has a fear of their well-being going forward, including losing their livelihood, there's precedent for leniency. If you take a look at source number 29, a passage from the Talmud, it says, even though we've said earlier you're not allowed to flatter wrongdoers, we talked about the case of King Agrippus, one may flatter the wicked in this world. They quote a verse from Isaiah, which seems to say, in the future, the repellent person will not be called generous, the stingy person will not be called giving, implying that in the future, but in this world, One may do so. You could say to somebody who's repellent, you're a fine, generous person. You could say to a stingy person, you're a fine, giving person. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish quoted a verse from Genesis. Jacob has the long-awaited meeting with his brother Esau, who had pledged to kill him. Right? And he looks at him and he says to him, wow, seeing you is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. So the Talmud says, you see, you are allowed indeed to flatter somebody in order to save yourself from harm. There's another passage in the Talmud which I didn't bring here on the sheet, in which one of the sages witnesses a murder. And the murderer turns to him and says, what do you think? And he says, good job. It's a matter of saving your life. And the ruling is, in fact, that where one is afraid for self-preservation, one is entitled to offer that level of flattery. If you take a look at source number 30 from a work of Jewish law, the Yeraim, he says, we have learned from these cases that one may flatter the wicked due to fear. Otherwise, it is indeed prohibited as flattery. So we have that leniency. We have another leniency, which is simply being silent, keeping your mouth shut. Don't say good things about it. Don't say bad things about it. If you're afraid that you will suffer bad repercussions, so don't say anything. So when it comes to the obligation of don't encourage wrongdoing, From a law society perspective, you're going to have to leave the retainer if it looks like you're encouraging wrongdoing. Jewish law is not necessarily going to require that if the result will be significant damage to your livelihood. Now, the question is always that how much damage is considered significant damage, and that's a case by case. That's one that I can't offer real overarching principles for. But the same thing is true when we look at the last duty, which is the duty to rebuke. We said there's a duty to educate people who are engaged in wrongdoing. Once again, we say, in the event that one could be personally harmed by doing so, including loss of livelihood, one would not be obligated to endanger oneself. Source number 31. Where there is concern for danger, one need not spend one's funds for the purpose of rebuke. Where you could lose your livelihood, you're not responsible to decide that you are going to be the one who's going to educate the wrongdoer. That can't be true for all cases, or there will never be a case of education, there will never be a case of rebuke. But the point is, there is a point where somebody is able to say, from a Jewish law perspective, I am not going to endanger myself so long as I am not acting on. So long as I am not acting in an inappropriate way, so long as I personally am not engaged in the behavior, that's already going to be good enough. So in terms of what we've seen at this point, number one, we've seen that you're not supposed to participate in or aid dishonest conduct, fraudulent conduct, conduct that is illegal. That's both law society and Jewish law. With the roots of it are different, in that the law society is concerned about your duty to the court and your duty to yourself. Jewish law adds the element of your allegiance to God and to Judaism. When it comes to what you're supposed to do to prevent these sorts of activities, Jewish law is stricter and requires even that you go outside of the business in order to prevent harm, including financial harm, whereas the secular system says only to prevent serious bodily harm, as well as where there's a duty to the court issue and possibly a significant harm to the public, depending on how one understands the Edgar Schmidt case. When it comes to the issue of default credibility, the law society is stricter than Jewish law and says you have to investigate, like in the case of use of one's trust fund, whereas Jewish law tends to be more trusting by default. And when it comes to the issue of harming yourself by leaving your job or dropping the retainer rather than violate your duties, secular law is stricter in this regard. Jewish law says as long as you're not engaged in the wrongdoing yourself, in the event that you would suffer a serious financial hit, you would not be obligated to drop the retainer. Where are the sign-in sheets at this point? I just want to make sure that I know where they are. So we have three of them here, one of them over here. Again, for anyone who came in after the beginning, but still was here long enough that they could reasonably sign in for this. Please make sure that you do sign in, especially if you want to get credit. I will send out, I expect, a follow-up email that will include the answer to your question about the successor on this point, as well as a digital copy of the source sheets. The next legal ethics class is Sunday morning, December 9th, for anyone who's trying to catch their credits by the end of the year. Sunday morning, 8:45, December 9th, and it's at the Bayit Synagogue in Thornhill. I'll be sending out all the information on the email list for the legal ethics classes. Our topic is romance and the elderly client. So that's... why is that funny? That's Sunday morning, December 9th. Yes. Shh. For anyone who has to leave, you may, but...
You skipped over the issue of whether there has to be an adjudication of the act to be designed or...
Okay. Thank you. Right. So the answer seems to be that it's about...